tell me that anymore.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development to order for Monday, April 29th, 2019. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 365A. Melissa, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 365A is relating to marijuana and has three parts to it. The first is prohibiting local governments from imposing system development charges for increased use of transportation facility that results from the production of marijuana on property located in exclusive farm use. The second issue is that it allows premises used for marijuana production to continue to be used for marijuana production if the premises was first licensed prior to local government prohibitions on marijuana production under certain conditions. And the third piece specifies that a person holding a registry identification card who is released prior to judgment of conviction, subject to a diversion agreement, sentenced to probation, or released on post-prison supervision or parole is subject to the same release, supervision, or diversion conditions related to prescription drugs. There is an emergency clause. This came out of the Senate committee with 4 ayes, 1 excused, and on the floor it had 25 ayes and 5 nays.
Okay. I'm going to call up Chris Doty and Rob Bovee.
Or was she going to?
Why not, Marianne? Sure. We have 3 chairs, so.
Welcome.
Please just state your name for the record and provide your testimony. Are you going first, Marianne?
I thought the commissioner was going first. Chair Lively, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Marianne Cooper, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. We've been lobbying this bill with what is now formerly Oregonians in Action, now the Oregon Property Owners Association, but Dave was unable to be here today. This bill came out of a work group that Senate Judiciary Committee led over the interim, and was something that was really brought from us and a couple of our marijuana growers in Deschutes County that had been concerned about the county's approach to regulating marijuana. And so you'll see, and I've just recently resubmitted our testimony dealing with only our original testimony outlined 3 things, one of which was very controversial that we opted not to pursue that amendment. And so for us, the bill now does 2 primary things. It ensures that counties do not charge system development charges for growing marijuana, for related to transportation, for growing marijuana in a farm zone. And to make it as simple as possible, marijuana is unique in requiring a county land use permit, and actually Deschutes County is unique in how they require their county land use permit for marijuana growers. And so because no other farm crop requires any sort of local approval, no other county is allowed to assess system development charges for anything related to that crop. When we found out that Deschutes County was doing it, they've been charging a pretty significant amount. I think one of our growers is bill last year was around $8,000 just for road infrastructure associated with having employees on his farm. We got very concerned because we said, you know, a lot of farms have employees. The amount of work required to farm marijuana is no different than anybody with a, you know, there's a lot of greenhouse produce grows out there, a lot of hay growers. They all have employees. And so we were concerned that Deschutes County was treating marijuana very differently than other crops in that regard. And so this bill would clarify that counties may not charge system development charges related to transportation for any farm use in a farm zone, and specifically for marijuana. And so, again, we think this is necessary because Deschutes County is the only county that is doing this. It's been a huge cost to the growers, and it's something that we think is fundamentally unfair given that the legislature has called marijuana a crop, has designated as a farm use, and it is being grown in a farm zone in a manner similar to other crops. So that's the first component. The second component is effectively grandfathering in marijuana growers and allowing them to still get their OLCC license, even in the event that a county opts out. And this is important because we've become concerned primarily out of Deschutes County with some concerns that have been raised in the county. A number of growers have come in and invested significant resources in their farms. And sometimes, for example, if you're doing a greenhouse grow, you actually have to transfer water rights to enable your water rights to go to more of a nursery type operation than a field operation. So they've invested a significant amount of cost and infrastructure getting up to speed in their counties. And we're concerned that if a county opts out, all of a sudden they're no longer a legal allowed use in that county. They couldn't get their OLCC license and they would be out of business. So we want to make sure that if a county has authorized a grower in the county, provided them kind of terms and conditions of how they have to grow, and then the county later changes its mind about marijuana, that means yes, no additional new grows can come in the county, but that grower can stay as they were and as they have been operating in the event of a county opt-out. And again, this is not a situation we've seen occur, but one that we've grown a little concerned about and want to make sure that we address that if somebody's invested in a business in a county, we're not going to allow them to be shut down or not be able to receive their state licensure just because the county changed its mind. So for us, again, these are coming out of two counties, but as Farm Bureau, we see a statewide significance, a statewide impact on both of these issues, and just want to ensure that marijuana growers have a level playing field with other farmers. A lot of them are traditional farmers that are also growing traditional crops on their property, and we want to make sure that their marijuana grows are treated as equally as they can be. Just as a side note, anything you see in the record around the time, place, manner restrictions, that was the provision. As an organization, we'd like to see those go away. Again, they're another way that growers are treated differently if they grow marijuana versus other crops. But we couldn't find the right language and the right path forward on that this year. So that was the amendment that we had hoped to get on the Senate side, but that is no longer part of the bill or part of the conversation. So any testimony in the record on those issues is not relevant to the two points that we are pursuing that are fairly minor in front of you here today. So with that, thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair, Vice Chair, committee members. My name is Chris Doty. I'm the Road Department Director for Deschutes County. I frequently get mistook as a commissioner.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On account of my gray hair. Never used to be this gray until I started working for Deschutes County. So Senate Bill 365 exempts a certain type of land use from payment of system development charges. SDCs are fees collected to mitigate the impact of growth and are used to construct new capital infrastructure to accommodate growth. When you exempt a land use from SDC, you're basically providing or effectively providing a subsidy to that land use, which is then picked up by other taxpayers and other ratepayers. There's no such thing as a free lunch. When you add trips to the transportation system, and those trips require a certain amount of infrastructure to be constructed, and SDCs are the method we use to, you know, construct and build some of that infrastructure. If you're not collecting system development charges from one particular land use, someone else is picking up that cost. Oregon SDC statutes are 30 years old. To date, no land use has ever been exempt from payment of SDCs within state statute. Not schools, not parks, not affordable housing projects. There are many sympathetic land uses out there that would not like to pay SDCs, but you know the system is not set up to accommodate that at the statute level. Locally, local government can make that decision to subsidize and find other ways to pay for infrastructure. But in the state statute, the legislature has resisted for three decades attempts to come in and become exempt from payment of SDCs. So exempting a specific use, I think, disrupts the integrity of the system development charge process that has been in existence for some time. Now, as mentioned, this bill has primarily been crafted to target Deschutes County, which is the fastest growing county in the state, if not one of the fastest growing counties in the United States of America. As such, we have tremendous transportation system needs, and the SDC is a very critical part of how we collect growth share, which is a pretty minor share overall, to mitigate the transportation costs and build the infrastructure that's required. The way our methodology works, an SDC for a marijuana grow operation equates to about 81 cents per square foot of building space. Building space that typically costs between $50 and $100 per square foot. So the SDC, the mitigation for the transportation impact, is roughly 1 to 2% of the cost of a construction project for a marijuana grow facility. So absorb that for a second. It's a very small piece, but again, it's the collective of those small pieces that amounts to the capital we need to build projects to stay up with growth in Deschutes County. And it's hardly cost prohibitive and certainly not punitive to any project, be it a marijuana grow operation or building a fast food restaurant. Senate Bill 365 is very bad policy for that reason. The consequences of passing Senate Bill 365 for that 1% to 2% subsidy that marijuana grow operations would receive, far outweigh the benefit of that. So, I would expect other land uses to take note of what's happening here in this bill. We don't like to pay SDCs. We're going to come approach the legislature and get out of that. And like I said before, there are many sympathetic land uses that exist that would not like to pay that. The decision as to whether or not to subsidize an SDC should be left to local government. And many local governments take advantage of that. Affordable housing is a common one where local governments can decide within their own individual SDC methodologies in a perfectly transparent manner where that SDC revenue needs to come from if they're not collecting it from a land use that's adding trips to the transportation system. Please recognize that Senate Bill 365, for those reasons, is just very bad policy. There's got to be another way to help subsidize what they're seeking to have subsidized here than to take something apart that's been in place and working effectively for 30 years. So please reject that. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Ovett, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties, here also in strong opposition to Senate Bill 365. I think I'll only talk real quickly, kind of at a 50,000-foot level, about the two first pieces of 365. I would first say ditto to what Mr. Doty said, but I find it kind of fascinating what happened on the Senate floor 2 weeks ago. There was an extensive debate about the nature of cannabis. It was kind of fascinating to me because it was in the context of two bills, Senate Bill 218 and this bill, Senate Bill 365. 218 was the temporary moratorium on issuing new licenses by OLCC. We're in a massive overproduction situation. We got 6.5 years worth of marijuana backed up in the system, and we're bleeding out marijuana hand and foot from Oregon, as well as now hemp in the last year, and the feds are not happy with us, so we're under pretty intense scrutiny again right now. So that was the context for 2 weeks ago on the Senate floor. And what was debated extensively in the context of both of those bills is whether or not cannabis should just be treated like any other farm crop, like tomatoes, like anything else. And I think ideally, in a perfect world, we would do just that. But we're not there yet. And I think this bill is another example of getting ahead of our skis. The feds are insisting that we do something about this overproduction situation, that we enhance, not degrade, regulation, and that we now do something about the new hemp leakage problem. And 365, I think, is just another example of, and I should let you know, 218 failed on the Senate floor. Was sent back to committee and it was amended and just passed the Senate floor again because, and I understand there was quite a debate about, gosh, we shouldn't be having a moratorium on the production of marijuana. It's just treat it like tomatoes. If there's too many producers, some of them will go away. Capitalism will take care of it. But the reality is, until the feds decriminalize marijuana and treat cannabis like both hemp and marijuana, like any other farm crop, we have a huge black market. It's just undeniable. And we need to regulate marijuana in a much more different way than any other farm crop. Would love to be at the point where that was not true, but we're not there yet. Quickly, as to the second part, and I'll just put this on the record because it probably won't matter and may never matter. I believe the second part of the bill is unconstitutional, as it essentially violates the Supremacy Clause of the Oregon Constitution by forcing people to stay at the party when they're not otherwise inclined to do so. But that probably is a moot point and probably will never get litigated because I don't anticipate anybody actually opting out that's opted in. But I need to put that on the record because I suspect that will lead to a lot of litigation if that ever came to fruition, unless, of course, the feds decriminalize marijuana at a federal level, in which case all that would be moot as well. So again, I think 365, while well-intentioned, is just we're getting ahead of our skis.
Very good. Questions of members of the committee. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify something because land use is not my area of expertise. The staff measure summary says SDCs cannot be assessed on farm use in exclusive farm use zones. But I thought I heard some testimony that there aren't any prohibitions on any type of land use for SDCs. So there seems to be a conflict there right now.
I'll try and then they can add to my. So Chair Lively, Vice Chair Fahey, system development charge is defined as a reimbursement fee, improvement fee, or combination thereof assessed or collected at the time of increased usage or issuance of a development permit, building permit, or connection to a capital improvement. Because agriculture in a farm zone is outright permitted, it doesn't require county approval. So you never get to the step where they have a development permit, building permit, or a connection to a capital improvement. So I would agree. I would agree with the testimony that, you know, there's not other exemptions because there doesn't need to be, because farm uses in farm zones are outright allowed. They don't have county approval. They're not considered an increased usage. And that's the same argument I would make around a marijuana farm. They're still a farm in a farm zone. They're not an increased usage of the system. It's just the fact that they trigger a development permit, the fact that they trigger a land use permit that has allowed the county to issue the SDCs. And I think that's what makes them so unique. And I know that, again, they were talking about construction. Ag buildings are exempt uses in agricultural zones. And so, again, it's just not something that's come in front of the county where the county has had the opportunity, because it is kind of the continued usage.
Got it. Practically speaking, there's no prohibition in statute, or there's no prohibition in statute, but practically speaking, there's no way to charge SDCs to farms.
Correct.
In EFU.
You don't get building permits, right, or development permits. Yeah.
McLean, please.
I will pass, so go ahead. No, that was my question.
Okay. That was your question. Oh.
So to what you just said, I mean, it's an outright permitted use to farm.
Right.
And that's the base. That's the base that we're on. Now, how we're arguing that on the other side, I just don't get. So I understood what you said as far as, you know, why system development charges are used and what they're for. But I do not understand how you get around the basis of farming as an allowed activity.
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, if I could maybe address that, and it's what I was going to say in response to the first question, which is we treat cannabis under Oregon law differently than any other farm crop. We actually carve it out for special regulatory purposes, including allowing counties and cities to have time, place, and manner regulations, as well as other forms of regulation that we don't otherwise allow for tomatoes. So when you talk about marijuana, at least at trying to keep the feds off our backs, we need to think more like, tobacco or essentially a regulated drug, not tomatoes. And so that's why in the bill, House Bill 3400 from 2015, we did treat marijuana as a farm crop with special exceptions so we could do special regulations, so we could try to, with some degrees of success, tamp down on how much we're actually exporting out of the state. Because unlike tomatoes and anything else, this is a high-value farm crop that is even more valuable if you get it to black market areas. And that's just the circumstance we're living in right now under the Williams memo, which supplants the Cole memo.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
That, to your last point, that somehow an SDC, or what are they called?
SDC.
That, right? That that they're being used to help us control a black market?
That's the other bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, no, I wasn't trying to make that connection. I was just trying to say that we aren't treating marijuana like any other farm crop. We are truly treating it as a special commodity, which is the words that got used on the Senate floor today when they passed 218. It's not like others. It's a carefully regulated product, unlike really any other farm product we produce.
Representative McEwen?
I think.
Oh, sorry.
Chair, I'm sorry. If I could also maybe follow up on that, provide a little perspective. The farming in Deschutes County is a function of water rights. Those water rights have been fully allocated for decades and decades and decades. Nothing new has been newly farmed, in the last 50 years. So that land that's being farmed has been farmed for lots of time. What's unique about marijuana is that it doesn't necessarily need water rights. You can have water imported, as many of the growers do in Central Oregon. The other part of it is that it's a year-round operation. It's grown indoors in Deschutes County. And so, excuse me, you have multiple cuttings. You have pretty much perpetual use throughout the year. And so that is another unique thing that that generates a lot of trips on land that previously did not generate trips. An existing farm parcel, it's growing alfalfa today. It's going to go grow corn tomorrow. That's all well and good. That property was generating traffic 50, 100 years ago in some cases. It's not generating any more, any less with a different type of crop. With marijuana, grown indoors, grown year-round, it has a substantially higher impact to the system. Here's what marijuana looks like in Deschutes County. Looks like an industrial building. It has a parking lot. It has, we recently had one come in the application process, has a conference room, has employee break rooms, several laboratories. And so it's a different type of land use than anything we've seen in terms of farming or anything like that. And so it certainly has a higher trip generation. It's putting more tax on the system. And so that's where, you know, we see that it's not just taking strawberries and planting tomatoes instead, or planting marijuana instead. This is new land use generating new trips, new impact.
Yeah, Chair Lively, Representative McLean, to respond to that, because it got a little far afield. I'd say any farm use requires water, and they have to have, especially in Deschutes County, and they have to have valid water rights. It's not new for some farms to import water, buy water from a neighboring city. That actually is an SDC not covered under this bill, so that would be, they could still charge for that. That's not an uncommon practice for vegetable growers or other kinds of growers. Nurseries commonly operate year-round. There are nurseries in Deschutes County. In buildings, just like the greenhouses in Deschutes County, not incurring SDCs because they're a farm use in a farm zone. The conference rooms, any additional facilities, anything like that, that is not a farm use in a farm zone. That is not the growing of marijuana or processing, for that matter. Those could both be assessed SDCs for the types of use that they are. We're talking about the growing of the crop, and in our experience, that is not a different labor load than, for example, I'm from Deschutes County. My parents buy their produce from a CSA in Deschutes County that is a greenhouse grow of tomatoes and produce and vegetable, grown during a longer growing season. Again, not assessed SDCs because it's a farm use in a farm zone. So we would say there is nothing markedly different about growing marijuana than other farm crops that are commonly found even in Deschutes County. Which does have a little less crop diversity than, for example, the Willamette Valley where we are now. They still have sufficient crop diversity where you see all of these kinds of uses in the same way that they are with marijuana. And so that they've kind of been trying to compare it to an industrial use the whole time, and we're keep saying we're just talking about the growing. We're just talking about the farm use in the farm zone, and there's plenty of comparable crops, even within Deschutes County, in terms of how they're grown, water usage, et cetera.
McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Lively. This is fascinating. I'm going to put a little different spin on it and ask you each a question. So here's the scenario. My brother-in-law had 40 acres out on the Swale Irrigation District. He sold it recently. He grew hay on it for years. He has water rights. If somebody bought that property and put up a greenhouse, hydroponic tomatoes, let's call it high-value tomatoes, or a Monrovia-type greenhouse, and had the water right to do it. It's an indoor growing situation where they're going to be moving product to market. The way I'm looking at this bill, you want an investment in the transportation facility. It's the way it's called out in the bill, right? So would they be subject to the same thing as a marijuana? What's the difference between something like that and a marijuana grow? Why is it different?
Well, it's different in that, well, for the majority of cases, I think we see it Deschutes County. If you're familiar with the county's land use, the zoning, EFU looks like sagebrush and rocks. And so we see a lot of grow operations occur on facilities.
How about the scenario I just gave you? Would you expect them to fall under the same proposal?
Yes. So with marijuana, they would be, or with, you're talking about the tomato example?
Or a Monrovia greenhouse or something. Pick whatever crop you want that's going to be grown in a greenhouse setting.
Sure. Yeah, in that case, they would not, incur a change of use. There was farming there before. There is farming there under the new proposal.
If they put a marijuana grow there and not a hydro, what if they had a hydroponic greenhouse and a marijuana grow?
The marijuana grow would be subject to the SDC.
That doesn't make sense to me.
If I may explain, from our perspective, it's a highly intensive land use. You've certainly are familiar with the amount of employment that's being generated by this specific industry. That employment has a cost to the transportation system as people need to travel to their jobs. And so from our perspective, we have this unique element regulated through time, place, and manner that's having a pretty significant transportation impact to our system. And we now have a means by which to address and mitigate that impact. I don't think tomatoes, have that same nature of the amount of care that goes into every individual tomato plant. Probably is not what you see with the product in marijuana. It's exceptionally different.
So your argument is the number of employees becomes an issue then?
Argument is you're going to generate a lot more trips growing marijuana, impact to the transportation system, than you would the existing alfalfa use, or if that was converted to, another greenhouse type scenario, because of the nature of how marijuana is grown, and just by our observation, the traffic impact and in the areas where we're seeing a lot of marijuana grow operations is noticeable and substantial.
I guess having been on ag for as many years as I was being involved in conversations about farm crops and adding this transportation sector piece, if you're driving a truck, if you have employees showing up, the impact on the transportation system is the one I hear you talking about. I'm not sure there's a strong argument that a particular crop is more intense than another, depending on what the crop is in any given greenhouse setting. I'm sorry, you're trying to call it out differently because I get it, it's cannabis. But the practicality of it is if you have another crop that takes the same amount of water and the same amount of care and has the same amount of employees and the same amount of trips to market, then can you honestly say a service development charge for one is fair and not the other?
Chairman, what we're saying is they're not apples to apples in terms of number of employees impacted the transportation system. And we think marijuana is substantially more. And I'd like to invite you to revisit the board's, Deschutes County Board of County Commissioners testimony in the Senate hearing. We provide pictures of some before and after development that's taken place where you have
a
20-acre parcel. With a nice Google photo from 2012, and there is, it's vacant, there's nothing there. Flash forward to 2017, there's a substantial amount of activity, 16 cars in the parking lot, and a tremendous transportation impact that's taken place due to the marijuana grow operation that's there. This has nothing to do with marijuana, has everything to do with trying to capture the impact and assess the transportation SDC to the proper growth entity.
I have plenty of questions here, but I'm going to finish. You have a question.
The discussion that just occurred was exactly the one I would
have
had,
very good. So I'll move over here to Representative Helm, I think, who's next.
I have some questions for Mary Ann.
And
they're just yes, no questions quick, and then I'll have a follow-up if that's okay with you. So Mary Ann, are you aware, I'm looking at Deschutes County, this is a little bit old census of the crops that are grown in Deschutes County, but it's from the USDA, and it gives us an idea of the types of things that are grown there. And so are you aware of an SDC that is imposed on any sort of grains in Deschutes County?
No, I'm not.
Are you aware of any SDCs that are levied on any sort of row crops, vegetables, melons, potatoes, sweet potatoes?
No, I'm not.
Are you aware of any SDCs that are imposed on nursery stock or greenhouse products?
No, I am not.
Are you aware of any SDCs that are imposed on poultry operations?
No, I'm not.
Are you aware of any SDCs that are imposed on cattle and calving operations?
No, I am not.
Which appear to be the second highest grossing agricultural use in the county. Any SDCs for dairy operations?
No.
Hogs and pigs?
No.
Sheep and goats?
No.
Horses?
No.
So there's no SDCs imposed on any other agricultural commodity in the EFU zones in Deschutes County at all?
Chair Lively, Representative Hall. That is correct, and correct statewide.
Okay. Cannabis is being singled out here, obviously. And I think we all can understand that ordinary use of the roads in any county in the state by ordinary agricultural equipment and semis for bringing in and out products is going to have substantially more impact on the roads than a few of our trucks and cars for regular use. I would just ask us as a committee, if we allow SDCs to be used in this way for these reasons, I'd ask us to think carefully about our wineries and carefully about our orchards and carefully about our wheat lands and our alfalfa lands further out. This really opens the door to a type of charging to our agricultural sector that we've never seen before. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Quite a few of my questions actually have been answered by the group, but I'll take advantage, if you don't mind, Chair. Thank you. I'm wondering whether or not it's foreseeable that SDCs at some point may be levied against any of these farm uses in Deschutes County in the future.
System development charges are levied at the time of land use action, and to the representative's long list of land uses, none of those have been proposed or have occurred in the time frame that we've had system development charges in place. Therefore, they wouldn't have never been charged in SDC.
And a follow-up? So from my perspective, I do sit on the Planning Commission in Clackamas County. I took that on to learn because land use stuff is absolutely mind-boggling. And I have learned a lot, and we've had a lot of marijuana issues in front of that group as well, and some recent review at the county commission level related to marijuana. And the testimony from community members has absolutely been that their impacts as neighbors, having lived in rural Clackamas County for years and having been neighbors with all of these agricultural uses previously, and to now be neighbors with a marijuana grow, their experience in that particular testimony, which is a different form than here, was that it was substantially different impact related to land use. And I understand in Oregon we intentionally put marijuana within a farm crop, and it's protected in that regard. And the fact that we have time, place, and manner already makes it different. But I guess my question is, when you guys entered into the and made the decision to apply SDCs to marijuana grows, from what I have understood from the community, I can understand how that would have some level of justification if your input from your community members is similar to what we have heard in Clackamas County. But when you made that decision, how did you come to that decision? Was there public input for that? Was that administrative? And how would you unwind it, barring legislation, or would you ever, would there be a time at which you would not do that?
So, Chair, Representative, the, excuse me, our SDC decision starts with our SDC resolution, which simply says, you know, when you have a land use that's being proposed or a change in land use, you can evaluate the before and after in terms of the number of trips that are added to the system. We charge an SDC based on a per trip, per peak hour trip basis. And so when this type of land use began to occur, we certainly had the same amount of public input that you had heard in Clackamas County. Did investigate the nature of, and this was back when it was medical at the time, did investigate the nature of it. And just determined that it was a land use that was generating traffic at a much higher rate than you know, the previous land uses in place. Did have to make some assumptions regarding how to assess that particular land use, because you know, you need to come up with a number of trips that are added to the system. We used one of the lowest trip generating per square foot land uses in the traffic engineering world to apply to marijuana grow operations, that of a warehouse, determine you know, the actual fee that I talked about in my testimony. And so that simply exists within our SDC resolution for us to decide that we did not want to impose a specific SDC, be it on an affordable housing project, a marijuana grow operations, or schools or parks, or what have you. The board would have to amend that that resolution and, you know, conceivably find a way to address that to the community's satisfaction.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deschutes County has decided to deal with a transportation need by levying an SDC. And in this instance, unlike a, let's say possibly a depletion charge, where some pay, many don't, based on the nature of the operation, this is a very selective group based on what is grown. If you did not have the SDC available to you as a county, how would you have met your needs for additional revenue in the county?
Great question, thank you. So, as I mentioned, Deschutes County, I think we're all aware, we're growing pretty fast. We have a lot of transportation problems in our county. And we collect upwards of about $1 million a year in system development charges for a capital program that's probably $6 to $8 million a year. So SDCs, even though, you know, we achieve them at that level, are still a small fraction overall, but that's growth share. And so how we make up the difference, now that we have House Bill, you know, 2017 funding in place, that's provided much needed capital for our county to build transportation projects. For the longest time, we've just been, like many other counties, a maintenance entity, simply maintaining what we have. And that's been difficult in Deschutes County because of the amount of growth that is occurring on roadways that in many cases, their alignment was in existence before the automobile. And so the SEC, you know, would certainly provide growth share of funding, but it would go through, I mean, we would have to make up for that by additional state highway funds through gas tax and whatnot.
So there are other options which don't expressly single out one type of business. Are you confident? Has anyone from the county or the county association investigated whether you are immune as a sublevel of government in the state to an equal protection claim?
Absolutely.
Chair Lively, Representative Witt, a couple of points. One is, I think it'd be really difficult to make out an equal protection claim right now with all of this being a federal crime. So it'd be a tough case to make out, first. Second, I would just say that I was wanting to add to what I heard before. I just disagree with what you've heard before as to the intensity of the use. Marijuana production is different, as described by Mr. Doty. There isn't any other crop that I'm aware of that we require a license from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to produce. There isn't any other farm crop I'm aware of that we track in detail. This is a labor-intensive process. And we have to do all this stuff to try to keep the feds off our back. So unlike tomatoes or any other of the farm crops or agricultural crops you've heard about here today, This is an intensive production use by regulation and just essentially to comply with now the Williams memo. So we are talking about a different crop with a different intensity of use.
So if we had a contractor, let's say an electrical contractor, located in an exclusive farm use zone, which is probably irrelevant, how, in order to conduct that business, there's a licensing process that's necessary, and I don't understand how the distinction that you make here hinges on the licensing process. In fact, I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but I wasn't convinced that this bill hinged on ag either, but that the claim may be from the Farm Bureau, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, that the perceived injustices treating one ag product different than a host of other ag products, but the reality may be that we're treating one business different than a whole, virtually every other business in our state. And so the problem may be bigger than what Marianne has presented here.
Chair Lively, Representative Witt, I think it is. It's a bigger problem because we have federal prohibition, and we're dancing on pins here. I got to tell you, I've never crafted statutes before that authorize state agencies to issue licenses to people to commit federal crimes. This is a very unique policy world we are in. And in terms of the business you mentioned in EFU, unless there are pre-existing use, you couldn't set up that kind of shop you describe in EFU. It just wouldn't be permitted. If somebody were allowed on some sort of conditional use, then that would be a land use application for which an SDC could theoretically be imposed because of the intensified use, which is the situation we're in now with this licensing of this new crop that still hasn't been federally recognized. So we're kind of in, we're breaking ground, I admit. I mean, we're in a unique space here.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the lively discussion today. I had some more questions about your trip generation analysis from Mr. Doty that you referred to earlier. So I'm looking also at your testimony online, and it says Deschutes County's SDC methodology assesses $4,000+ per peak hour trip added to the system. Now, normally, from my experience in the planning realm, there are industry standards that apply to different kinds of sectors that guide us in what that peak hour expectation could be. In the case of the cannabis industry, there's no equivalent industry standard, I would assume. So how did you assess the peak hour impact? Did you do traffic studies?
Chair, Representative. Mm-hmm. So we did have to find what we felt was the most analogous use.
Which was?
Which was a warehouse. Now, the industry will catch up to the marijuana, both at the retail level, have caught up to, actually, there is a retail trip generation rate in the latest volume of the trip generation manual. And so that piece is taken care of. With new and emerging land uses that don't have establishment, within our country, there aren't any comparable. There's no data to basically tell you how much it grows. So we made the assumption of a warehouse. For one, it's one of the lowest trip generating variables in the manual. We did, what we have done is just kind of take a look at other land uses that have developed, the various marijuana grow operations. And we haven't performed any traffic counts yet because it's still a very emerging and new industry that isn't fully developed yet. There are, however, several in Deschutes County that are mature from the medical side. They have substantial trips added to the system. They have 16 cars in the parking lot for about a 40,000 square foot facility. We think we're definitely within the ballpark of what a reasonable SDC rate would be for that type of facility, if not underestimating.
Thank you. follow up, but warehouse is a pretty general category, it strikes me. I mean, typically associated with a manufacturing facility or other kinds of facilities, certainly not a grow farm use associated kind of entity.
True, it's the most, like I said, it's the most analogous we felt, not just looking at the type of use. I mean, let's, you know, there is a lot of marijuana grown in industrial warehouses in this country. And so that was one factor to, you know, now is that factored into the trip generation data that's been collected nationwide? Maybe not. A warehouse is primarily devoted to the storage of materials and goods. And, you know, being, that it's a fairly benign type use, it's storing something. We felt that worthy of the analogy to compare, you know, a grow facility. And then they have minor, associated offices and so on, a typical warehouse does. And so we feel comfortable with it. We know that the industry will catch up to us at some point and provide data. And I personally believe we're probably underestimating based on just the amount of added traffic to our system we see in certain areas where we have multiple grow operations.
One more question. So I think I disagree with you in terms of the comparable to a warehouse. I think a lot of warehouses are extraordinarily busy places where people come and go and lots of activity takes place. But set that aside, you note here that this equates to 81 cents per square foot of construction. That's the formula that you've used to actually apply it. So do you apply this to outdoor grows or do you have them in Deschutes County?
Deschutes County does not have any outdoor grow operations.
If you had outdoor grows, would you apply them?
We would have to come up with a different variable.
A variable for that situation?
I'm not sure how we would go about that. It probably would come down to a number of plants and trying to determine how that would work. The other piece that we would factor into that thought process is, the indoor grow operation components that you see within the warehouse grows in Deschutes County allow for multiple cuttings per year, 3 to 4 harvests, and so they're generating more traffic, whereas outdoor, certainly based on the environment, and currently the time, place, and manner regulations require it to be indoors in Deschutes County.
Yeah. Chair Lively, Representative March, I would point out that is Deschutes County Commission's choice. I think they're one of the only commissions that has banned outdoor grows, and a lot of the growers would prefer to be able to grow outdoors. So in some respects, the fact that it's in greenhouses, and I would dispute ever calling them warehouses, although again, Deschutes County's had concerns about night skies ordinances and wanting and so forcing them to be opaque, which is again, requires a higher electricity usage because you're not making use of the sunlight if you have to have opaque walls. So a lot of the reasons for the grows being as they are in Deschutes County are by Deschutes County's doing, and again, make it very different than other counties because they have chosen to be very restrictive in how they allow it to be grown even within the county. And that is the reason that they're only indoor grows is that's their own design. It's not a state mandate.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would just comment that I would consider it a dangerous precedent in any circumstances to begin counting or making determinations on anything based on the number of plants that are grown. I think this flies squarely in the face of the understanding in much of the agricultural community that we maintain a right to grow here in the state of Oregon. And when I hear people starting to count the number of plants, I don't care what crop it is, my antenna goes straight up. And I see that as a warning signal. And this is going places, Mr. Chairman, I'm entirely uncomfortable with.
Further?
Chair, if I may, that was in reference to crafting a trip generation rate. The science that goes behind figuring out the number of trips that are added to a transportation system based on a certain type of land use. I think that may have been taken a step too far as a comparison there. That was in response to that specific question.
Any further questions? Representative Drazen.
Thank you, Chair. So if there are currently cannabis businesses that have some portion of their facility that is eligible for you to charge SDCs, conference rooms, or I think you referenced something else too. If that's the case, why cross to that next level and choose to apply the SDCs to the cannabis grow activity itself?
Sure. So far, it's based solely on the square footage of what's constructed. The fact that as a grow operation, most of these have those elements to them. It's just a factor of the land use in whole, not in part.
So you're applying it to the building, not the growing of the crop?
Correct. We're applying it to the square footage of the structure that's been constructed, just like any other SDC.
So last question. So, but do you also apply a separate SDC for any other portions that are not grow-related, but it's just the building in total, and some portions of it for growing and some are for conference rooms or some other activities?
Sure. We don't break apart.
You don't break them apart.
Just like you wouldn't with any other business that has office space, a break room, so on. It's typically based on the square footage of the structure. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a one-time fee. As uses change, within the industry, you typically don't reassess, different portions of the building separately.
Last question. Does the state give any other guidance to any other local governments as it relates to system development charges that are used locally that you're aware of? Do we prohibit anything else related to SDCs for counties or cities or anybody else?
Sure. To my knowledge, there's no prohibitions within state statute. That was a central part of my testimony here today. There are restrictions on types of methodologies. You can't have a methodology that's tied to a number of employees. You have to have a methodology separate from that. But I believe that's the only restriction that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
I have one that I think is short.
Moment, okay.
Thank you, Chair. Is there, you don't have any wineries in Deschutes County, because it's probably not, or do you? And if you do, would you charge them an SDC?
Chair, we do have at least one that I can think of. An SDC would be charged for the commercial portion of any commercial activity that they have. So the one that we have, I believe, has a venue for events and so on. And I believe the building was charged a system development charge for the commercial aspect of it.
Because that requires a special use permit, because it's not an outright permitted use on EFU?
Because it was a, as to whether or not, I'm guessing it was a conditional use. But it's simply, they submit a building permit for a specific type of land use, the commercial aspects of what they're proposing. It's not related to the size of the winery at all. It's or the number of grapes being grown. It's related to the square footage of the building and how much that building, how many trips would be generated by the commercial use.
Permitted use. Thank you.
To clarify, one point of clarification, it is not on the grapes, nor would it be on agricultural buildings associated with the grapes. And so what he's talking about are the commercial parts that are for public facing, and we're not alleging that is a farm use. And for marijuana, we'd again be fine with assessing an SDC if somebody had a facility associated with their marijuana grow operation. We're concerned about the farm side of the operation.
Representative Bonham asking a question. Representative Bonham, please.
I just want to make sure I understand. So the SDCs right now are being charged on the primary production facility and not on the hoop houses, or on both?
Chair, the SDCs are being charged based on the square footage of the grow area and any associated uses that would be attached to that.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for hearing us first. Appreciate that.
No problem. Thanks a lot. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 365A, and I'll open an informational hearing on infrastructure finance programs at Business Oregon. And I believe Chris Cummings and Ed Tabor are here.
Welcome.
If you want to talk about SDCs, that'd be fine.
Okay. Just checking.
Today. Thank you.
Okay.
My name is Chris Cummings. I'm the Assistant Director for Economic Development at Business Oregon. We've been asked to come here today to discuss our infrastructure programs, of which we have many. They are basically the foundation for economic development. In other words, I'm sure you understand that if you don't have proper water and sewer or industrial lands, there's no business really that's able to locate in your community. Today, we'll cover quite a few programs. We'll do a high level of each of the ones that we'll go through. You're welcome, of course, to stop me, as you did with the prior folks, to ask any questions or dig a little deeper into any of the programs. Just to give you an overview of our department, we have about 135 people. You can see the economic development division there. All of our infrastructure programs are in that division, so we have policy folks that work in each of the programs, but we also deliver these programs with our outreach people. Some of you, I'm sure you've dealt with regional development officers that our department has. They're out selling our infrastructure programs and our business programs. And then we have regional project managers who actually make sure the work gets done, and they manage the projects for these infrastructure programs. Today we're going to go over the programs that you see listed today. Special Public Works Program, which is our flagship fund, if you will. Water, wastewater financing program, safe drinking water, seismic rehabilitation, and community development block grants. All of those programs, those five programs, except seismic rehabilitation, fall under the purview of the Infrastructure Finance Authority. And this is statutory. So they have oversight of how we spend the funds, if you will. They delegate much of that to the staff, and as well as policy. We're also going to cover brownfields, industrial lands, ports, broadband, and infrastructure, regional infrastructure fund, just slightly. That is the fund that's managed by us, by Business Oregon, but it's otherwise known as the Regional Solutions Team program, funding program, but it's really called Regional Infrastructure Fund. Of note, on this slide, ports is also within the purview of the Infrastructure Finance Authority. So the Special Public Works Fund, really, when I say it's our flagship program, it's one of our largest, it is our largest fund, and it's the most versatile fund that we have. Most of Special Public Works, and as a matter of fact, most of our infrastructure programs are loan programs. They're not grant programs, which is something we always hear about, right? We need more grant funding, but the fact is local communities pay for the infrastructure that they're building, and we offer favorable rates for those communities. Now, what's available in public, the Special Public Works, as you can see, it's for planning, design, infrastructure improvements, replacement, emergency projects, and pretty much anything that's infrastructure involved in a community. When I mentioned, when you see emergency projects as a result of a disaster, what this fund does is it provides the 25% match to FEMA funds if there's a federally declared emergency for infrastructure work. So if it's something like shoveling snow, that's not infrastructure. So we can't pay that match. But if the road gets washed out or a culvert gets ruined, we can pay for that match for the community.
Pay for the match. So it's not a loan, though.
Chair, no, that's a great question. That is one of the areas where we have a grant. So okay. We will grant those communities. We do have standards, and I believe it's up to $2 million a biennium?
$2.5 million
a biennium per rule that we give away in grants. And the primary purpose of having those rules and those caps is because it's intended to be a revolving loan fund. So if we give everything away, eligible entities are, as you can see on that slide, they're cities, schools, counties, tribals, tribal councils, ports, special districts. We have mosquito control districts. We have all kinds of special water districts, all kinds of special districts in the state that are eligible for these funds, again, as a loan primarily. We have one airport district, and I guess I put that up there because I found it interesting. We only have one, and they're a big customer of ours. So what can we fund? Obviously, airport facilities. We can loan, as some of you may know, airports get 90% grants for infrastructure improvements. We can loan the other 10%. Sometimes they need that. Sometimes they just have, like, at the airport district in Coos Bay, which names escapes me.
Southwest.
Thank you. We helped pay for a building so that they could have tenant improvements that helps offset their costs for operations in the airport. Levies, we have a levy set aside that the legislature's approved for accreditation and certification and repairs of levies. Telecommunications facilities, we can loan now on telecommunications is really how it started with us, but that includes broadband. As some of you may know, because of the large discussion on broadband lately, the loans aren't exactly the most favorable thing for communities to want for broadband. storm drainage, wastewater, railroads, port facilities. We do have a special port fund that we'll talk about, but in times when that fund is light on funds, we can still loan out of this so that we have a revolving fund available to ports. Give you an idea of the Special Public Works Fund generally is that it's primarily lottery bond funded. So we have a request this biennium of $79.5 million of lottery bonds to recapitalize or further capitalize that fund. And loan repayment is basically how we're paying for the grants that we give out for staffing. Obviously, across a state this size, it takes a tremendous amount of staffing to be able to manage these programs. And we can do bond banks as well. And we just did one recently that helps us further capitalize our fund. What we did in this case was we packaged loans that we gave out, and then we sold those loans as bonds, which is great to help us get more money. What it is a negative for is that we can't use those funds, repayment of those funds, to give out loans or grants to pay for our staffing, et cetera, because when we get repayment on those loans that we sent out for bond, it has to go right back to the bond. But it does allow us to raise capital when we need it, and we did need it this past, it was 2018, first bond sale we had in about 8 years, so we did need those funds. This current biennium is a little bit less than last biennium, but we, as you can see, we awarded about $32 million so far in Special Public Works Fund, 38 projects. Most of our projects go to rural communities. It's not because we don't like urban communities. We love urban communities just as much. They don't necessarily need our assistance as much. They have bond ratings. They can package their loan or infrastructure requirements with other bond sales. The communities that need these funds the most are rural communities that don't have bond ratings. They may not have, there could be one person working for the community, so our staff is really helpful in capacity building for that community. And frankly, our terms are much more affordable for them, even if they had a bond rating, because they don't have to pick up those bond costs. So to give you an idea of what the terms are for Special Public Works, is we can do loans up to $10 million, generally speaking. We can go over that if we so choose. The IFA board would have to approve that. But we try to keep it around the $10 million, and we have gone over in a few instances. We usually go out 25 years on amortization. We can, by statute, go out 30 years. We try to leave the extra 5 years in case communities run into any issues. It gives us a little bit of ability to restructure that loan. As of right now, and since at least as far as I know, the last 3 years, we haven't had any defaults on loans. Sometimes communities get into trouble. We can restructure a little bit, but statutorily, we can't go out beyond that 30-year mark. Interest rates, give you an idea, right now they're 3.96. Obviously, they fluctuate. Our board decided to tie those to the 20 bond index. So from time to time, there was a time period where we still have some old loans that are, 7%+. We do see communities lately refinancing in one way or another if they can access bond markets or other means. But we can't refinance loans statutorily. So once we give a loan, that's your loan. The great thing about our loans, though, is we can do construction and permanent financing. So if any of you have ever built a house, you go for your construction financing, right? And then you close on that, and you have to get another loan. We do it all together in one package. And then a great thing about the guidance that our board has given us and the long-term procedures that we have is the debt service coverage ratio has to be at least 1.20. So communities have to have the ability to pay us back. They have to show that if they're going to take a loan on a building, say at an airport, that's going to have lease there, that they have to have sufficient funds coming in from that lease to pay us back. So in other words, we won't loan to communities that can't pay us back just because we have loans. I mentioned to you that we primarily do loans, and really that we tell people that all the time because they come to us for grants and we don't want to disappoint. So we just tell them we start off with we only do loans, but we do have some grants. We offer technical assistance grants for planning, grants for planning and development projects, firm business commitment grants. That's a grant. First of all, for this one, it's called a forgivable loan. The community meets the terms of the forgivable loan, and then we forgive it. In this case, if a community is going to locate at a particular property in a community, the community can take this loan for us and have funds forgiven per job cost. It's our tie-in with our business development. I mentioned the levy grants, and then we have, I mentioned emergency grants, and we have levy grants primarily for planning. The other thing, so that's a general look at who's eligible, what's eligible, you know, the terms of the funds. But Special Public Works to us and state is so much more than just a loan program, in that I've had lots of comments about people liking or not liking the circles. That's where I could land. I'm not that innovative as far as drawing. But the Special Public Works Fund, it pays for our water wastewater fund, which you'll hear about from my colleague here. It pays for our staffing, which is in terms of where you see capacity assistance, right? We don't simply wait for applications from communities and ask them to fill it out and throw money out at them. We help them build projects. We work with the regional solutions teams. We work with their other partners. We have a program called One Stops that if you have a water, wastewater, or any other project, we'll sit you down in the room with our staff, our finance staff, and our external partners, whether they're state or federal or nonprofit partners, and find the best deal for you. So that's a lot of capacity building that we have. The Special Public Works Fund also pays for, you'll hear about the Community Development Block Grant, it's CDBG, that is a federal program. We have a local match, state match, so it pays for that. Safe Drinking Water, the SSDW there, that's a federal program. We pay for that match with Special Public Works. And then, of course, the grants, that's where the levies, emergencies businesses comes in there. So it's not simply just a loan program as a direct, it pays for other support services.
Representative Drazen.
Thank you, Chair. Can you tell me, you might have said it in the beginning, I might have missed it, how long has Business Oregon had the Special Public Works funds, the grants and the loans? Has this been something that's been going on for years and years, or when did this come to be?
Chair, Representative, we started it yesterday. No. I'd have to go to check, but I believe Special Public Works Fund has been at least, I would imagine, at least 20 years plus. Mm. But I can certainly check for you and get the exact date when it was implemented.
Just wondered if it was timed with the adoption of the lottery and whether or not you guys have had access to these programs from the beginning. That's just mostly what I'm curious about.
We can find out.
Thank you.
So I have a couple of questions. So the amount that communities, and so you talk about a loan, I'm trying to understand, is there a restriction on the percentage of the loan the state will take? I mean, can your loan be as much as 50% of the project? Can it only be 10%? What's the range, or how is that decided, and how much position the state would take in a public works project versus the local community?
Chair Lively, I'll let my colleague step in on that. I believe it's 100% loan on a project that we'll take. So if you're putting in new water system and you need a reservoir and pumps and it costs $3 million, we'll loan on that $3 million.
So is there any, I'm trying to understand from the standpoint, since you talk about this being more rural than urban, and I appreciate the reason for that. So is there any other criteria from the standpoint of showing need? I'm just trying to understand the basis on which the decision's made to take it 100% versus half and trying to provide more money for more projects is what I'm trying to get at.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name's Ed Tabor. I'm the Program Incentives Manager for Business Oregon. I'd like to add to what Chris just mentioned. As far as how much we'll lend out. It's also on the community's ability to repay. So as he talked about, we'd look for a debt service coverage ratio of 1.20. We would look to user rates for repayments and their ability to repay a $3 million loan. So oftentimes we'll see a community that may come in for, say, a $6 million loan. We say, you can't really afford that. You go back and maybe re-engineer, and they come back to us with a less expensive project, one that the community is then able to afford.
So another question, and maybe you get to this later. I'm trying to understand, because, again, it's been 20 years longer. I worked with this program as an economic development, and that seems like many centuries ago, but I don't know how far it was. But I'm trying to understand, because you're talking about now requesting 70-some million dollars this biennium. So what I'm trying to get a handle on is, so how large is a fund? And if indeed the majority of the fund is loans, then I'm trying to get in, the loans could be 25 or 30 years. I'm just trying to get a sense of that. When do we keep putting substantial new investments in versus enough of the loans have been repaid that we have money to deal with the projects, or do we ever? Is there any anticipation that the fund itself will be enough to address these needs versus having to continually every biennium replenish the fund?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, in my opinion, we would be decades away from the fund being self-sustainable.
Okay.
If that depends,
sure.
Of course, on the legislature, how much money they would award, but to be able to cover our admin costs and keep the program similar, we would need a very, very large infusion, much more than the money we're asking for.
And do you track, or do we have statistics on the amount of funds requested biennium versus how much you ultimately loan, so we know, so we would have some sense of the total community projects out there that are looking for these funds versus what we have available?
Chair Lively, we do have statistics. How we operate now is that we're, you know, a financing entity, at least for infrastructure, is that we are, we're not at the point where we have to make this a competitive process. So generally speaking, we don't have to turn away people unless, of course, they can't meet standards, and we'll say you need to come back.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, along those lines, on revolving fund, how much do you have out right now in existing loans?
Do we call? Oh, thank you. Chair, Representative, we have a little over $120 million out in loans. Our return, just for what it's worth, is about $10 to $11 million a year of repayments. To give you an idea of where that match comes in from Special Public Works, is I just wanted to have a little screen here. It's EPA Safe Drinking Water Program. That's the you can see in 2017, 2018, how much we provide as match, and then we leverage the $11 and $14 million. By the way, and it'll touch on it, the Safe Drinking Water Program actually is an OHA Health Authority program, except we have an intergovernmental agreement with them where we have the infrastructure to do loans and the staff, so we do that for them. And same with HUD. You can see that our match to HUD is actually quite small, and it leveraged quite a bit. Here's our pipeline. Now, pipeline for us is difficult to predict in a way. We know that we can look historical. Right now we have about $36 million in Special Public Works and $7 million in water wastewater, which, by the way, come from the same funds, the monies that, if we're lucky enough, that you authorize for lottery bonds, they fund the same program. These are folks that we know that are ready at some point to take a loan. It's not a competitive process, so we don't go out to, like some grant programs, ask everybody to apply and then put the people on the wait list. So this has been relatively stable, as you can see, projected $25 to $35 million. Of course, if the economy changes drastically, we could see that change as well. One thing that we are realizing as an agency are larger projects. Projects cost a lot more now than they did even 5 years ago. Communities are willing to take on more debt than they were 5 years ago. And certainly the infrastructure is at an age where it just simply needs to be replaced. Quick, here's a couple of projects on the right. Yes, on your right, we have Lebanon. where we did a water intake. That was quite a large project. If I remember, it was over the tens of 15 million?
22 million.
22. I wasn't close at all. And Albany, on the left there, where we helped fund streetscapes that's being paid back with urban renewal dollars. So communities have different ways to pay us back, too, as opposed to just general fund. With that, I'm going to turn this over to Ed Tabor here, and he'll go into some of the other programs. Can you reach?
Yeah, I got it.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, thank you again. My name is Ed Tabor. I'm the Program Incentives Manager. So next up here is the Water Wastewater Fund. Again, this fund provides loans and grants to communities that receive or are about to receive a compliance or notice of noncompliance from a regulatory agency. We are not the regulatory agency, but we step in to help the communities get on the right track there with the funding. Eligible projects include planning, design, and construction of water, wastewater, and stormwater systems. Disadvantaged or distressed communities may be awarded grants up to $750,000 and interest rates as low as 1%. The primary source of this funding is lottery bonds and loan repayments. The Safe Drinking Water Program, as Chris mentioned, is a federally funded program that we provide the match for. Business Oregon administers this program on behalf of the Oregon Health Authority. The program provides financing and other assistance to publicly and privately owned water systems to further public health protection goals of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act and the Oregon Drinking Water Quality Act. Couple of projects here. The city of Yahats received a $640,000 forgivable loan and a $760,000 low interest loan. The city of Yahats had experienced some water availability issues in the past, mainly to the residents and businesses on the south end of Yahats. With increased drought circumstances and impending disasters, the city is taking steps to secure capacity with the construction of a 250,000-gallon finished water storage reservoir and a pump station and valving to supply water to the residents and businesses of South Yahats and Lincoln County in the case of an emergency. The other is the Springfield one is the Rainbow Water District. Again, they received $2.5 million loan and a $500,000 forgivable loan or grant. The district will construct a new treatment system to treat the water and construct a new transmission line to allow adequate chlorine contact time for disinfection and to improve seismic resiliency of the existing cast iron transmission line. The seismic rehabilitation program was created by the 2005 legislature. The program was originally with Oregon Emergency Management, but transferred to Business Oregon in 2014. This is a competitive grant program that provides funding for the seismic rehabilitation of critical public buildings, particular public schools, and emergency services facilities. So this slide shows you what we've done this biennium, $120 million, $100 million for schools, $20 million for emergency facilities. Schools are retrofitted to life safety standards. Life safety means that a building may be damaged beyond repair during an earthquake, but people will be able to safely exit the building. If a school project is considered a shelter project, then those buildings are retrofitted to immediate occupancy, as are emergency service buildings. Immediate occupancy means that not only will the building remain standing from an earthquake, but emergency services will be able to continue to operate and provide services.
Chair Lively, member of the committees, if I may, just to point out that these are general obligation bonds. They're not lottery bonds like most of our other programs, so just wanted to be clear on that.
I'm sorry to interrupt your testimony, okay, but I'm having a flashback to fifth grade when the Columbus Day storm hit. So when you say the definition has to do with earthquake, I know having typhoons in Oregon is very, very rare, but it has happened. Would that preclude that from, talk about the definition of earthquake versus any type of disaster.
when they do the seismic retrofits, that's what they're building them towards, seismic retrofits. So that's what they're making the analysis towards. Would it benefit also from tsunami and things like that?
Or typhoon.
Typhoon. Mm-hmm. Again, their primary focus is on the earthquake, building it to those standards. But it certainly would probably benefit in those. I'm not an expert on that, though.
Thank you.
Since these are competitive grants, is there any consideration given to how close, what seismic zones these facilities are located in versus others? Because we know from a standpoint of the seismic zones, the closer to the coast, the more likely structures, whether they be emergency services or schools, are going to be impacted versus way east. So I'm trying to understand, these are competitive grants, there's only so much money left, is part of the criteria, whether they're in a higher seismic zone or not, versus just anybody can get it based on some other criteria.
Thank you for the question. The facilities that they ultimately select from when they're categorized into priority, they look at the worst of the worst buildings first. That's how they make the prioritization. But in that said, though, they do make an effort to not just fund all the schools that maybe in the coastal region, that we have grants made available throughout the state.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
The Community Development Block Grant, as Chris mentioned, is a federally funded program from HUD that provides rural, non-metropolitan cities and counties with grants to help develop economic opportunities and create suitable living environments for lower-income households. Recent award examples of Community Development Block Grant include the City of Irrigan, which received a $2.5 million grant for their wastewater treatment system, or the eight communities, the Dalles, Harrisburg, Pilot Rock, Staten, Ontario, Roseburg, Astoria, Union County, that each received $400,000 for their housing rehabilitation program. For CDBG grants, a match is not required. However, all funds needed to complete the project must be committed at the time of award. This here shows you the funding of this last biennium, 20 projects for $15.8 million. CDBG is the largest available grant source for infrastructure and community facility projects that are geared to assist small rural communities with a majority of low to moderate income households. CDBG is an annual competitive grant cycle. Our agency is driving to achieve transparency in the implementation of this program by utilizing our partnership with AOC, LOC, and other stakeholders in a CDBG annual action development committee.
Representative Drazen? Oh, Wallen, sorry. That's only the second time, isn't it?
I think so.
Okay, that's good.
Very good. All session, actually. Very, very good. Do you do all of the pass-through for CDBG? Are you involved in all of them that all communities in the state do, or just some?
Chair Lively, Representative. Portland metro regions receive their own allocation, and we don't have anything to do with those. We only handle the non-entitlement areas.
If I may, Chair, Representative, the entitlement areas, I don't have them all memorized, but Salem, Portland, Medford, Eugene.
Gotcha. Okay.
And I think now Albany and Ashland.
Okay, that helps. Thank you.
Since these are federal funds, so is this a diminishing source of funds that you have available to help communities or not?
Yes, these funds are federally funded, and we've seen our amount stay fairly consistent between $11 to $12 million. This last biennium, $11 million and $12 million respectively in each of the years. So. So the next program is the Brownfields program. The purpose of the Brownfields program is to assist individuals, nonprofit organizations, private entities, and local governments with financing to evaluate cleanup and redevelopment. The department manages two Brownfields financing funds, the Oregon Brownfields Redevelopment Fund funded by state lottery bonds. And these provide fundings from assessment all the way through cleanup. And the Oregon Brownfields Cleanup Fund, which capitalized through a grant from the US EPA, funding for cleanup only are eligible. Matched funds come from a variety of sources, interest income, and revolved funds locally brought forward to the project. So the local funds that help provide the match. Example of the Brownfields program would be the Coquille Wharf Integrated Planning Project, which was a $25,000 grant to the Coquille Indian Tribe. In March 2004, the Coquille Indian Tribe acquired the former Weyerhaeuser North Bend Export Services site. The tribe contracted with a professional environmental consulting firm to compile and review the environmental assessment and cleanup records, and two, to identify information gaps requiring further investigation and cleanup of the property. There are an estimated 13,500 existing brownfield sites in Oregon throughout the state. Currently, there at any one time, there may be 450 active projects. And again, this is revolving. These old sites move off. New sites, unfortunately, come on. So the demand, as we see, is throughout the entire state of Oregon.
So is the definition between rural and urban consistent through all your programs? If I were to go look up the definition, it'd be clear which in each one of those programs, what a rural versus an urban project is?
Chair Lively, by statute, rural is anything under 30,000 population. The county as well, but so Albany right now is it used to be lower rural until recently. Now it's over 30,000, so.
They're not. Thank you.
The Oregon Broadband Office was established within Business Oregon by a governor's executive order in December 2018, which states that the office shall, in addition to the services listed on the screen here, that the office will manage and award funds allocated to the Office for Broadband Projects. The governor's recommended budget includes $5 million for rural areas. Develop and maintain the Oregon Broadband Map, which in this is a platform for data collection to track the availability of broadband services across the state of Oregon. So Business Oregon helps manage or helps with the website and provides a website for local communities where you can actually drill down to individual house sites that show what type of broadband capabilities are available. In fiscal year 2017-18, Business Oregon tested a $500,000 pilot program for rural broadband. The pilot provided grants for the support of broadband planning, engineering, and infrastructure development projects targeting rural and underserved populations. This was a highly competitive award process. Business Oregon received 22 applications for over $4 million, of which 7 projects from across Oregon were selected. And the Regional Infrastructure Fund provides state investment grants to leverage public and private investments to address economic priorities in each of the 11 regional solution services program areas. Business Oregon administers the funds for regional solutions. These, again, are lottery bond funded. During the 2017 legislative session, the legislature authorized the issuance of $4 million for which were awarded to 18 projects and are currently under contract. This concludes my presentation. We'd be happy to entertain any questions, obviously.
So what's the difference between the regular infrastructure program and the regional infrastructure fund from a standpoint? Are there different projects you can fund, or where are those two different?
Thank you for the question, Chair Lively. Generally speaking, the Regional Infrastructure Fund is a grant fund. Mm-hmm. So that's competitive, and as you, I'm sure you know, it's regional. So there's some selection process there. There is some difference in what we can fund. For instance, Special Public Works Program, the end user or the end owner has to be a public entity. of the facility. So if we fund a street, this, right, the city has to keep it. With regional infrastructure funds, the applicant can be a public applicant, but the end user can be a private entity. And it's a little more broad, too. Schools are eligible. Community colleges are eligible. Those are not eligible entities under other programs.
Very good. Any other questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thank
you. So nothing further to come before the committee. I'll close the informational hearing and adjourn the meeting.